Hey there, tax fans. Welcome to State Tax Talks with me, your host, Joe Tantillo. I'm a tax attorney at the Hodgson Russ Law Firm looking to explore the nuances of state and local tax law. Here on the show, our goal is to keep tax informative, simple, and fun. So if you're ready to talk tax, turn up the volume and dive into this episode of State Tax Talks. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. I'm sitting here with two of the titans of the state and local tax industry, Mr. Paul Como and Mr. Mark Klein. We'll be interviewing these two gentlemen about their experience in the state and local tax practice and some of the history and development of this area of law in a few brief moments. But first, I'm going to tell you a little bit about each of them. Paul Como is a senior partner here at the Hodgson Russ Law Firm. He is the chairman emeritus of the firm. He graduated from the University of Buffalo School of Law. He's been practicing law in New York since 1974 and in Florida since 1975. He's worked on state and local tax matters since very early in his career, written numerous articles, books on tax residency, including co-authoring the New York Residency and Allocation Audit Handbook. He's worked on some of the most instrumental cases in the state and local tax practice, founded and chaired various commissions on tax policy and residency, and he's been recognized with numerous awards for his achievements in tax law, including being named on the Best Lawyers in America list from 1987 through today. Sitting here as well is Mr. Mark Klein, current partner at Hodgson Russ and the current chairman of the firm. He is a University at Buffalo law graduate as well. He's licensed to practice law in New York, Florida, and New Jersey. He has more than 35 years of experience with federal, multi-state, state, and local tax issues. He's a renowned public speaker on various tax topics, and Mark has appeared as a state tax expert on CNBC, CNN, and other various news outlets. He, too, has authored numerous books and articles on the topic of tax, including co-authoring the New York Residency and Allocation Audit Handbook with Mr. Paul Como. Mark has been a pivotal figure in the area of state and local tax for many years and has also been recognized as one of the best lawyers in America in tax law from 1995 through today. Gentlemen, welcome and thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having us.
So we're going to start all the way back at the beginning. This area is something that the two of you have been instrumental in expanding. But when you were in law school, the concept of a full-time state and local tax attorney, did it even exist? Was it on your radar?
So I graduated from the UB Law School in 1973, and there was no mention of state and local taxes. Over the years, they added state and local tax courses taught by Mr. Klein, among others. But when I was there, the tax courses were all federal tax. And when I joined the Hodgson Russ Law Firm in 1973, they didn't have a state and local tax practice. The head of our tax practice, Don Lubick, had a case, the Knee-High
bottling.
Bottling case, yeah. Right. And that was the case that people talked about because it was very, very unusual for anyone to win a case in the state tax field, and he had actually won that case. But that was it, and that was many years before we joined the firm. And so when we came in 1973, we had no state tax practice. We had a very small firm. We only had about 35 lawyers when I joined the firm. And the tax department was only a handful of attorneys. But one afternoon, one of the attorneys who was just a couple years older than me walked over and said, "How would you like to be Perry Mason today?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "I'm going over to a state tax hearing. You want to come with me?" I said, "Okay." So I walked over with him. We participated in a hearing before a hearing officer. We had witnesses there. At some point, this attorney turned to me and said, "Would you like to ask the witnesses some questions?" And I said, "Okay." And so I asked some questions. And as we walked back to the office, he said, "Did you enjoy that?" And I said, "Sure, that was fun." He said, "Good. You're now handling all the state and local tax cases. Low man on the totem pole gets the state and local tax." And I said, "Okay." And so I wrote the brief. We ended up winning the case. The client was quite pleased. And then as other state and local matters came in, I got them.
I mean, keep in mind, there was no state and local taxes tax course because there wasn't much in the way of state and local taxes. You know, Paul started in 73. New York didn't have a sales tax until 1965. Our income tax was 4% back then. I mean, now it's up to 10.9%. Connecticut didn't have an income tax at all. So lots of changes in the states have caused them to need money. And as a result, they've started, you know, triggering all of these taxes. And so now, yeah, these taxes are quite substantial, which is one of the reasons the state and local tax field has taken off. I think another thing, Paul, I think you'd agree, is we were able to really develop the niche in state taxes because the big firms, you know, the big Wall Street firms really didn't care about state taxes. I mean, if I'm a, you know, a white shoe lawyer in New York City doing a big transaction, I care about, back then in the 80s, taxes were 50%, federal taxes, 50% was your rate, even higher if you go back to Kennedy's 70%. So they cared about those big dollar numbers. Nobody cared about a 4% sales tax, which is what New York started as. Nobody cared about the little nonsense. They cared about 50% or 70%. And that's kind of one of the reasons I think that Hodgson Russ was able to develop a name for itself, because we cared about that little stuff. We knew we weren't going to get the major merger of some giant corporations, but we do get the major merger because those big firms in New York City started referring work to us, little work that they didn't want to be bothered with, transfer taxes, sales taxes. And I think that's one of the ways we got a foothold in the area.
Sure. And when did New York exactly really start, you know, these sales tax audits? When did they start chasing people up for 4% to the point where people think, man, I should get myself an attorney who knows what they're doing in this area?
Well, they started doing sales tax audits right after they did the sales tax, but there wasn't a lot of guidance out there. There weren't a lot of regulations. There wasn't a lot of clarity even nationwide. New York has been a leader in putting out guidance on all kinds of things, various rulings. They had the Instructions and Interpretations Unit, which no longer exists.
Right.
They had other advisory groups within the tax department that would write you a letter. If you had a question, you could write them a letter. They'd give you an answer. A lot of those things have been eliminated as they've gotten more structured with regulations and things like that. But the other interesting thing is, as Mark said, they didn't even have a sales tax till 1965. I think they currently have about 40 different kinds of taxes. They have cigarette taxes, highway use taxes, corporate
hotel
taxes,
room taxes, short-term automobile taxes versus long-term automobile taxes.
And in virtually all of those areas, as New York turned a corner and came up with something new to tax or started actually actively auditing people in a particular area, we were there. And because we had built a reputation for successfully handling cases in various areas, many times we ended up being on the front line of handling issues for the new tax as it popped up.
How did you go about handling the cases in those early days when you had a lack of guidance from the state, a lack of a complex tax code? You know, we see it today.
Well, that was the best part, right? The best part was, unlike federal lawyers who had this huge repository of case law and guidance and regulations and rulings, we didn't have anything. So we were able to create the law, and the judges really didn't have a lot of guidance behind them either. So it helped us, I think, become creative and come up with arguments that turned out to be, in the most case, for the most part, winning arguments based on the fact that there was no real guidance out there. It allowed us to basically start with a fresh, clean canvas and start painting ourselves. I think that's one of the things that actually interested me about state taxes, because unlike federal, where, you know, it's nationwide and someone somewhere has handled a case involving whatever you're doing. You know, there's nothing new under the sun. In New York, it was all new. And sometimes it still is.
So in the earliest days, when a dispute would arise, the question was, who handles this? And so New York State had what they called the New York State Tax Commission, and that was the tax commissioner and two side commissioners. So they were the commission. And so the commission, theoretically, was responsible for running the tax department, making legislative recommendations to the legislature, having laws changed, putting out regulations, interpreting the law, putting out rulings and guidance, interpreting the law, and then, if you had a dispute, adjudicating the dispute. And they didn't personally adjudicate the dispute. Instead, they had hearing officers. So hearing officers would be assigned. And many times, the hearing officers would sit there and seem to agree with us, and we thought everything went well. But then we would get the final decision signed by the three tax commissioners, and it was completely different. The facts were different. The analysis was different, and the conclusion was different. And we thought, what happened? You know, these people weren't even there, and where's this coming from? We subsequently found out what was happening in terms of how these things were occurring. And we, on behalf of the New York State Bar Association and others, I chaired a special commission or committee of the New York State Bar Association that was charged with trying to create an independent tax tribunal for New York State. And we met with the Judiciary Committee, we met with the Senate Finance Committee, Ways and Means, Tax Department. The tax department, of course, was very reluctant to give up this ability to basically make the law and then interpret the law and then adjudicate the law. But under Commissioner Rod Chu at the time, we were able to convince them that this was the right thing to do and also convince the legislature. And so the New York State Division of Tax Appeals was created. And that was an independent tribunal set up with administrative law judges and then a three-member tribunal and so forth. Quite a bit different, quite a bit fairer, better decisions. We pushed to have their decisions published, which initially they didn't want to do. Art Rosen and I were the co-authors of the New York tax cases, which were the famous red books, which were the compilation of the decisions because they agreed to publish them, except they didn't have any money to publish them or print them, and so they actually weren't available. And there was no such thing as online at the time. It was either paper or not at all. So if you won a case, you got a copy of the case and you might share it with a few friends. The tax department knew about every case they won or lost. So we said, that's not fair. So we created this compilation of these cases and suddenly everybody knew what was going on in the tax department. And then obviously with new technology and so forth, all of that has become obsolete, but everything's available online now. But anyway, it was a very, very different world when we were doing these things. And we were there evolving with it and helping, as Mark said, to shape it.
Wow, that's quite a dramatic shift in procedure and process that you had a hand in really shaping, which is incredible. One of the things that we have specialty here in at the firm, as the two of you well know, but our listeners may not, is tax residency and tax residency controversies. Now, we talked a little bit about how sales tax audits were prevalent at the beginning of your careers, but when did the tax residency piece become a bigger issue for the New York State taxpayers or the non-New York State taxpayers, should I say more correctly?
That was in the late 80s. New York State had a little experiment. They sent out about 130,000 letters to people saying, you claim to be a resident of Long Island or Connecticut or some other place. Prove it. And to their amazement, they received from those people amended tax returns in about half of the cases without having to do audits.
People
and they
conceded.
$30 million or so of instant revenue. And thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Maybe we should actually assign auditors to this and have field audits and so forth and see, you know, ask people who are asked to prove these things, the people that didn't respond and send us their money.
There were a lot of misconceptions, and there still are a lot of misconceptions about residency. Historically, people used to think, hopefully we're changing their minds, but used to think that all you need to do is go to a state like Florida, fill out an affidavit of domicile, register to vote, get a homestead exemption, and change your driver's license, and then the domicile fairy would tap you on the shoulder, and you were now a Floridian. And New York didn't really care about nice pieces of paper. They wanted you to actually live in Florida, and a lot of folks didn't. They spent their time up here. They would spend the winter for a couple of months in Florida, and yet they claimed that they were Floridians. And so, yeah, as Paul said, New York got instant money, and they realized, we got a gold mine here. And keep in mind, Joe, one of the best things about New York's residency program is that they're going after people who claim to be non-residents, meaning they don't vote here anymore. They have no political constituency. If you're going to go after a target audience, get the ones that can't vote you out of power, right?
You know, it's really a brilliant strategy by the state when you think about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have all the power because, of course, the taxpayer has the burden to prove this change. You know, in those early days, you're arguing these cases about domicile. As you said, a lot of people are just thinking, well, I'll just pack my bags, go to Florida. I'm there 6 months or you know, 6 months.
Yeah,
a day.
Yeah. The other misconception is 6 months and a day,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And now I'm all set. But you know, when you're arguing your first tax residency case or the first that you can recall in court, you know, how do you approach this concept of domicile that is the very soul of it is getting to the heart of the taxpayer, you know, getting to their subjective intent, and you're lining up against the state for the first time and saying, well, you know, here's how we're going to prove this, right? I mean, that has to be difficult.
And keep in mind, the burden is on the taxpayer to prove it by clear and convincing evidence, not just preponderance, excuse me, clear and convincing. That's some serious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I always find it very difficult to understand sometimes where the tax department's coming from, because as you point out, it's a subjective standard. What's in the taxpayer's heart? What's in their head? The problem is we can't see your heart. We can't read your mind. So we have to look at the objective facts that, you know, the objective standards and what you've done. We have to see really what are the facts. You can say you're a Floridian all you want, but if you don't actually sleep there very often, that sort of undercuts your argument, right? If your kids are going to school in New York and you say you're a Floridian, once again, it raises some questions. So yeah, it is a tough nut to crack, but we've been quite successful in cracking those nuts.
And we've handled thousands of those cases, far more than any other firm in the country, as far as I can tell. But some of the earliest cases, one of my earliest cases was for a very wealthy Palm Beach person. And he had a very unfortunate situation where in a particular year he had to be in New York more than he otherwise would have been. Somehow they picked up that year. Somehow they audited that year. But the interesting thing was that he had moved to Florida in the 1970s. And he had no New York source income, so he didn't file a tax return for about 30 years. And when he got audited in about 2000, and New York recognized that he hadn't filed for about 30 years, they were asking him to prove where he was going back 30 years.
By the way, this is before cell phones and other ability, you know, other things, technology to find out where you are. This is just, you know, do you remember where you were 20 years ago?
No constant government surveillance through your cell phone to exactly. pinpoint your exact location at all times. You know, how.
And even EasyPass didn't exist
no
back
EasyPass.
Then.
No EasyPass. Right? No SunPass.
Yeah.
And
credit cards?
Well, and who keeps records for 30 years, which
sure.
was the point that we made. In fact, there was another case, a sales tax case, where someone had a boat in Sag Harbor, Long Island, and New York State tax auditors were going around looking at boat registrations, and they saw this boat, and they wrote down the number, and they checked their records and found that there was no sales tax paid on this boat that they could find. And so they contacted the owner and said, prove to us you paid sales tax on this boat. And he said, I bought this boat 25 years ago. Well, did you pay sales tax? Well, actually, I didn't pay sales tax when I bought it because I was planning to rent it out. And so it was a purchase for resale, which would not be subject to sales tax. But after a year or so, I realized I hadn't rented it out. So I decided I would just use it myself. So I paid the tax. Let's see a copy of the check, front and back of the check. Let's see this. Let's see that. Different proof. And he said, who has that? They said, well, go to the bank. The bank doesn't exist anymore. Go to your accountant.
Three banks
My accountant
ago.
Is dead. Go to your attorney. He's dead too. You know, and they said, well, you have the burden of proof, therefore we're assessing you. And it actually went before an administrative law judge who looked at it, and this poor plaintiff, self-representing, said, who keeps records for this long? This is ridiculous. And the judge, in effect, said, I agree. Case dismissed. But anyway, we did a very good job on that residency audit for that client who was facing 30 years of exposure, and he told all of his friends who told all of their friends, and thousands of cases later, this practice has really thrived. But a number of these cases had to be litigated. The ones that haven't been litigated aren't public, and we're very careful not to disclose who our clients are. A number of them have been litigated, and some of the leading cases in the state and local tax area are cases handled by our firm.
Sure, sure. Do you think back then, you know, when the availability of third-party records was, you know, less significant, that taxpayer testimony played a larger role in the ability to come out victorious in some of those cases?
For the most part, first of all, no one was doing residency audits, and one that I handled was back in the 70s. But other than that, there was a big gap between then and about the end of 1980s when New York started doing these audits. So by then, still weren't cell phones, but there were records. And also, when the state started doing these audits, there were no audit guidelines. The audit guidelines came out in the 90s, 92, 93. We commented on the guidelines. We helped shape the guidelines. We basically litigated some of the guidelines. But for the most part, there were no guidelines. There were some regulations, but they were very cryptic. And ultimately, though, the tax department did issue some very, very thorough guidelines, and they've updated them every few years. So there's a roadmap that people can follow. If you do all of these things, you should be okay, except that, as Mark said, the ultimate question is still, what was your intent? And that's sometimes hard to prove, and the burden of proof of the taxpayer is a very heavy one.
Yeah, and testimony is great when it comes to your intent. But a lot of these cases also focus on, you know, where do you sleep at night more often? Where, and of course, you know, New York, like most states, has a rule that says if you keep a place in New York and you're here more than 183 days, then you're instantly taxable regardless of whether you're a Floridian or a Connecticut resident. And since the burden's on the taxpayer, you know, testimony is interesting. But, you know, let me ask you, Joe, where were you on March 13th earlier this year?
Oh, that's a great question. I couldn't tell
and
you.
Think about what these taxpayers have to do. I'm asking you about this year. I'm asking you about, you know, just not that long ago. Now you got to go back 3-4 years and tell the auditors, you know, where you were, not based on your memory, because your memory is not going to do it. You got to have third-party documentation, a contemporaneous calendar, things that a lot of people didn't keep, and trying to identify where you were. I mean, even back then, unless you had a really good airline, keep in mind, airline tickets were in paper. And most people, after you got your boarding pass in paper, you threw it in the garbage because you'd already taken the flight. No reason to, you know, to keep a boarding pass after you've flown. And so a lot of taxpayers said, well, look on my credit card. It says, you know, I was in Florida. It says trip to Florida. And the auditors would say, well, that just says you bought the ticket. How do I know you didn't turn it in? How do I know you actually flew? So it got real difficult. And a lot of taxpayers also think, well, I'll get you an affidavit from my friends that say I'm always in my New York home, or I'm always in my Florida place, or I'm always here. Those are fairly meaningless unless your third party or friend has either a phenomenal memory or some way to back up why they remember you. You know, I'm the doorman in your place and I can see the days you were in, you know, your Florida home. I can look at it. If you don't have that, then affidavits are meaningless. Just, I see Joe Smith once in a while. What does that mean?
Or if you are a commuter coming in from New Jersey, coming in from Connecticut, or coming in from Westchester, but working in the city, and you have an apartment in the city, but you're very careful not to spend more than 183 days in the city, you're only there 182 days, the auditors will look at that very carefully, and they may find days when you just don't have any evidence at all, and say, you have the burden of proof, so on that day where you have no evidence, we're going to assume you are in New York, and therefore you're over the 183 days, prove to us we are wrong.
Right, so incredibly complex, incredibly nuanced area of law, and the two of you were at the forefront fighting these battles very early on.
Right place at right time.
At what point do you realize that you've won enough of these cases, you've handled enough of these cases, that you're prepared to literally write the book on how to approach this practice?
Well, the interesting thing about the book is that we wrote the book in the very beginning, because as I said before, when the tax department created the Division of Tax Appeals in 1986 and started making decisions but not publishing them, and we decided we better publish those since people have to know what's out there. It can't be just the tax department that knows what the cases are. The guidance came out. They came out with guidelines, but they didn't widely disseminate those guidelines. And so the very first version of our book was largely a copy of their guidelines and extensive commentary by us on what the guidelines, how the guidelines might be interpreted, some ambiguities, some of the strengths or weaknesses, some of the economic development issues or other reasons why perhaps a particular guideline should be altered or eliminated, things along those lines, which again helped shape the guidelines over a period of time. And a summary of cases. If there were cases out there that were interpreting the guidelines, that were interpreting the rules, because the guidelines are only the guidelines. The courts aren't bound by those guidelines. Guidelines of the tax department are not regulations. They're not statutes. They're just guidelines. And sometimes you will see a court saying, well, the guidelines say this, but I noticed this. And therefore, for example, there was one case, the guidelines say that one secondary factor is the place you claim as domicile in important documents such as your will. And in this one litigated case, the taxpayer was asked, do you have a New York will or a Florida will? I have a Florida will. Prove it. Fine, here's the will. Okay, it's a Florida will. Well, in the court decision, the court said the taxpayer was asked to prove he had a Florida will. He presented the Florida will. However, the court notices that the will was prepared by a New York attorney and was signed, witnessed, and notarized in New York. Well, the guidelines don't say anything about that, but the court noticed that. And that was just one of the many negative factors. The taxpayer lost the case not because of that, but it certainly wasn't helpful. Well, why would you think that that's something? But obviously, when we are guiding our clients, we know about the nuances so that the guidelines say A, but it's really A plus or A minus because of some of the decisions that are out there, some that we've been involved in and some that others have been involved in.
And by the way, the auditors are also well-trained in this area. And, you know, until taxpayers are represented, auditors love to talk to taxpayers. I had one taxpayer who was chatting with an auditor after she received the notice, and the auditor said, well, how much time do you spend down in Florida? Oh, I spend, you know, 5 months, 6 months, 10 months, whatever it was. And what do you do in the summertime? Oh, I come back home. Well, that word home certainly showed up in the auditor's logbook later and was a very harmful factor because this woman, again, if you're trying to figure out someone's subjective intention, the place you refer to as home, was the place in New York. So we often tell our clients, we always tell our clients, please don't talk to the auditors. Nothing good will come from it.
I had a similar case where the taxpayer left New York with his family, young children, moved to Europe. The children were in school. He was working there. His wife was working there. They had met in Europe. She was from Europe. She was from the country that they went to. They were there for a few years, but then they had a problem. One of their children had a learning disability that they couldn't treat appropriately there. So they decided to move back to the United States, but not to New York, but to a completely different state where there was a doctor who specialized in this area. And when they received the audit questionnaire and the question was, tell us what you did when you left New York. They explained moving to this European country, but they said, before we permanently moved to Florida. And using the word permanently suggested that the move to Europe was a temporary move, not a permanent move. And therefore, during all the years that they were in Europe, they were still New Yorkers because they had left the old, but they hadn't landed in the new until they landed permanently in Florida or Colorado or wherever they ended up.
There's a great case. We didn't litigate it. The case, I think, is called Haney, H-A-N-E-Y. But the fella left New York lock, stock, and barrel, got in his Winnebago with his wife, traveled around the country, and a couple of years later finally wound up in Florida. And they asked him, you know, during his hearing, you know, tell us about your situation. He said, well, I absolutely left New York, and I guarantee you I had no intention to ever return. Yeah, but you didn't get to Florida until 3 years later. And therefore, he lost his case because, again, as Paul said, you not only have to leave, but you must land, and you have to stick the landing. And one of the things about New York auditors, I'll tell you, is they have phenomenal 20/20 hindsight. So if you're back or you're in someplace other than where you started by the time the audit begins, there's a good chance the auditors are going to suggest that that was always your intention.
Guys, thanks for those thoughts. Folks, this is a good time for us to take a pause. We're going to continue this interview in next week's episode. So if you want to hear the exciting conclusion of the interview with Mark Klein and Paul Como, please tune in to next week's State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo, where we've got a lot more stories and great insight into the world of state and local tax. Thanks for joining us for another episode of State Tax Talks. If you're interested in listening to more episodes, we're available on all platforms where podcasts can be found, including YouTube. If you enjoyed this episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo, please give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. And if you're in need of a tax professional, you can contact the tax attorneys at Hodgson Russ. Go to www.hodgsonruss.com for more information. And until next time, I'm Joe Tantillo, and this is State Tax Talks. Catch you later, tax fans.